Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Welcome to Masonic Central, your podcast for Freemasons by Freemasons. Today is March 15th, 2009. This is Greg Stewart and my co-host.
This is Dean Kennedy.
And welcome to our show. This week we have a very special guest with us who's been very gracious to come onto the show. She's arguably the best academic historian of Freemasonry in America today and quite possibly the world. She's the author of three books, The Origins of Freemasonry, Facts and Fictions, Living the Enlightenment, Freemasonry and Politics in 18th Century Europe, and The Radical Enlightenment, Pantheists, Freemasons, and Republicans. And just to recapture her book now that's out through the University of Pennsylvania Press, Freemasonry, Facts and Fiction, we have the distinguished professor of history at UCLA, Dr. Margaret Jacob. Professor Jacob, welcome to the program.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
I want to sort of touch base early in this conversation and talk a little bit about your prolific background now in the study of Freemasonry. I'm curious, how did you find your way to its study?
Yes, well, I get asked this a lot, and I'll tell you the honest-to-goodness truth, and that is that I was working on a very specific historical problem, and that was, how did Isaac Newton's science get transmitted to the continent from Britain? Now, that seems like a silly question. You'd think, well, people just read the book. But the fact was there was enormous opposition to Newton's understanding of the universe from Aristotelians, who occupied all the professorships in the schools and universities, and also from the followers of Descartes, the Cartesians. So it was actually a very controversial move to embrace Newton's thinking. And when I asked that question, I was led to the French language journals written in exile by French Protestants located in the Dutch Republic. And there I found a group that were meeting in 1710, calling one another brother with a grandmaster, and talking about meeting under their constitutions. Well, I spotted Freemasonry of some sort. But this was, of course, supposedly 7 years before the Grand Lodge of London was founded. And this led me from one step to another. Making a long story short, I was then led to a large collection of manuscripts at the University Library in Leiden. And there I found about 200 letters talking about Freemasonry. I looked at these and I thought, I don't know what this is about. So I said to the librarian, is there a Masonic library here in the Netherlands? And she said, yeah, take the number 10 bus and go down to The Hague. Went down to The Hague with a Xerox copy of one of these letters, walked into the Library of the Grand Orient, said to the librarian, do you know who this person is? He looked at the letter, he read it through, he said, my God, this is one of our founders. So that's how it all started.
Just from your description of it, it almost sounds as if the Grand Lodge there was unaware that the documents existed. Were they as shocked as you were to have found them?
Yes, they were. Now, the original document I had found in the papers of John Toland, who was an early 18th century deist and freethinker. Now, he had long been associated with Freemasonry. There were books on that subject and him, all coming from the 1920s. But this was the first time anybody'd seen how these links might have worked. And, of course, then I began to try to pursue the story on the British side. And I'll tell you a kind of funny story. My husband at the time and I had letterhead stationery with both our names and our address on it. And I wrote a letter to the Grand Lodge in London, saying, would you mind terribly if I went and used your archives? Because I'd like to see if I can find out something more about this group. Well, the Grand Lodge in London, in its wisdom, this was about 1978, wrote back to my husband and said, no, your wife cannot use our archives. Only Masons are allowed to use our archives. So I then wrote back and said, but since I'm a woman and you won't let me in, surely the rule doesn't apply to me. Well, they never answered. But regardless of all that, I got them to change their policies. But most of the work I did was on the continent. It was in The Hague and in Paris.
Greg? I'm sorry. Over how long of a period of time did that work start to manifest? Did it take several years, or was this process in fairly short order?
No, it took 3 or 4 years till I pieced together what I thought was an adequate story. And I published it in 1981, and I received tremendous flack, mostly from Masonic historians who said, this is impossible. This group cannot be Masonic. And this went back and forth for a while. And then I decided the way to clear this up is to do a general book on European Freemasonry in its golden age, in the 18th century. And that was the thing I did. Well, the next time I turned to Freemasonry, that was what I did. And that book came out in 1991. And so it's gone. In the meantime, some of you may know this story, but so stop me if I'm repeating the story, or some other speaker you've had has told you about this. I don't know whether you realize that when the Nazis came into The Hague and Brussels and Paris in 1940, they went to the synagogues, the liberal political parties, and the main lodge archives in Paris, The Hague, and Brussels, and took everything, took all the archives they could get their hands on. Shipped all these back to Berlin, where Hitler had an institute that employed over 200 people, the purpose of which was to discover the roots of the Jewish Masonic conspiracy. Well, to make a long story short, the Russians got those archives and sent them back to Moscow, where they beautifully cataloged them and hid them away. Well, in the year 2000, these Moscow archives were sent back to their rightful owners in The Hague and Brussels and Paris. And suddenly, historians had an unprecedented doubling of the Masonic records available in Western Europe. And I was asked, would I like to be one of the first historians to go and use those in Paris? And I did. And so you start on a topic, and it has a way of coming back to say to you, well, you need to do more. But in the meantime, I've done a lot of other things.
It's an interesting story. Did you ever at any time find your way back into linking it into Newton and your original interest in the topic?
Yes. I've subsequently published also on it. And my bread and butter work, you might say, is the history of science and technology, which may seem far removed from Freemasonry, but it actually isn't at all, at least in the 18th century.
I've heard of the documents, but I've had the luck of actually being here in Los Angeles and hearing you speak before on it in regards to the documents that were taken by the Nazis. Have those documents, you said that they've since been returned, have they been archived as yet? Has anybody made a full inventory or a...
Yes, they're available now in open to the public in Paris. Brussels. I've worked in the Brussels archives as well. There's not much there for the 18th century. It's much richer for the 19th and 20th centuries. And indeed, I have a colleague here at UCLA who's working on the Belgian material. And the material in The Hague is also now available.
It almost seems to lend itself to suggest that the history that we so frequently refer back to in Freemasonry may be a little more flexible or a little bit changed than what we're used to. Did you come to any conclusions in looking at those documents? Any sort of foundations as to the earlier origins of Freemasonry besides the 1717 date that we always tend to go back to?
Right. Well, unfortunately, the Continental Archives didn't help very much with the origins in Britain. But as you know, other scholars have been working on this. I mean, just recently I received a paper on Christopher Wren and his Masonic associations. And I think now that, excuse me, there's enough evidence for us to say that the speculative lodges exist in the 1690s.
And when you say exist, it certainly would seem to lend itself to say that for them to have existed then, there would have had to have been an earlier period of development. Any speculation as to how far back that it goes?
I'm not sure. Certainly, the Royal Society had members who crossed into Freemasonry as well as science. And so there's actually quite a bit of overlap there. So, and we would assume that these men are, quote-unquote, speculative. They're not stonemasons. They're not working with their hands. Although someone like Sir Robert Morais, who belongs to both, is an actual practicing engineer mason, but he's a master architect. So you do get some overlap, but on the whole, the gentlemen of the Royal Society are not folks carving things out with their hands.
This may be asking you to go out on a limb a little bit, but have you had an opportunity to ever read the book by Robert Lummis, his Freemasonry and the Birth of Modern Science? He actually explores that topic a bit, perhaps not relying on the most accurate information, but he seems to dot his I's and cross his T's. I'm curious if he had any thoughts to his work on that.
I'm sorry. I'm ashamed to say I don't know the book. Who published it? Do you remember?
I can tell you. I actually have it right here in my library as we speak. It's a book, Robert Lummis, and it's out of Fair Winds.
Mm-hmm.
In it, he actually goes through and quite extensively outlines the roles that Morais played with it. And just in what you're saying, it just seems to lend some credence to some of his ideas that come from this book.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting to see what develops from that.
Take a look.
From your study of it, though, from where you started to now, any particular points of interest that stand out to you, things that you may not have realized in the beginning, but have since come to find a particular affection for?
Well, I've gotten a chance to also direct a few graduate students working on this, and one in particular, young woman, Natalie Bayer, who's PhD at Rice. I sat on the committee for it, and she's done a tremendous study of the spread of Freemasonry into Russia and has shown how in the last third of the 18th century, 30% of the books being published in Russia were being published by the Freemasons. So she's documented that spread. We now know much more than we ever knew before about the Eastern as well as the Western side of the story. And the other thing I've gotten interested in, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
The other thing I've gotten interested in is the formation of these conspiracy theories that take shape. The earliest pamphlet that I've found is from the autumn of 1789 in Paris, at the beginning of the French Revolution. And then it becomes a kind of cottage industry to produce books on the Jewish, not the Jewish, just the Masonic and the philosophers who were supposedly involved in conspiracy to create the French Revolution.
Go ahead.
Is alive and well in the 1790s and is spread then in the English speaking in Germany and France, in Italy. And in the middle of the 19th century, it gets reworked into the Jewish Masonic conspiracy. And what I've discovered is, if you trace this kind of thinking, it almost invariably is part of a fascist mentality. This is true in Franco's Spain. It's true in the people who continue to publish the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is regularly produced in Kuwait, for example. So it's a particularly nasty myth that has a way of just keeping coming back. And I think it feeds into the general mentality around Freemasonry that this is some kind of sinister conspiracy. And I cannot tell you how many times people ask me about the conspiracy to the point that I'm well and truly sick of hearing about it.
and it's interesting that you should mention that. We have a guest that has been on the show previously, but that's going to be coming back to actually talk about the work of Una Birch. In regards to the secret societies, Illuminati, Freemasons, and the French Revolution, maybe this is stretching a bit, but in any of your study with it, besides the pamphlets, any other connections that you found to link the Masonic conspiracies with the Revolution?
I'm afraid there isn't a shred of evidence, not a shred. Now it's true that if you think about the lodges as operating in the 18th century as schools of government, in the sense that they taught men how to vote, how to speak on their feet, how to lead an organization, to become articulate and polite, they taught manners. As a result, about 10% of the literature that appears in 1789 at the French Revolution is by Freemasons. It's just that some of them are royalists and opposed to everything that's happening. And some of them are moderates and some of them are Republican radicals. So you get the entire political spectrum. And as you would expect, if in fact what's happening here is that people are being taught to think about government, but they're not being taught how to think about government. They're just being taught that they, as ordinary people, can have a role in government.
Go ahead, Greg.
Go ahead, Dean. No.
I was going to say, Greg, because I know I rarely speak, it sounds more like the philosophical schools of the day that when you're talking about, you know, making people think about the government and during the revolution, there was these schools of philosophy. And I was just wondering if there's any connection with Masonry with those schools. Is that going too far away?
No, it's not far away at all. There's a connection to the extent that Masonic rhetoric in the 18th century almost invariably invoked, in whatever language they were talking, invoked the notion of enlightenment. The Freemasons in Dutch are Verlichte, in French they're Lumière, and so on and so forth. And this is part of the rhetoric of Freemasonry. And does that mean they are enlightened? No, it does not. But it means that they're in touch with the sort of fashion, the avant-garde fashion of the period, without necessarily themselves accepting the views of Voltaire or Diderot or any of the leading lights in the movement.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of when I said that. Actually, was Voltaire and Rousseau and those sorts. And I was just wondering.
Well, Rousseau is not connected in any way with Freemasonry, and Voltaire, seems that the only real connection is toward the end of his life when he's invited to the Lodge of the Nine Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little evidence of his having any real interest in it up until that time. Now, Ben Franklin, that's a different story.
Yeah. That was my question, Greg. You had another question?
Yeah. No, actually, that was brilliant. That was a brilliant question to follow it up with. I want to change the topic a little bit here, in more specifically about something that you're doing now that still may tie back to these ideas back then. But you're here in Los Angeles. You're about to give a presentation in a few weeks at my lodge, thankfully, on the paradox of secrecy in the 18th century Freemasonry. And I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, What I'm trying to point to is that, yes, ostensibly the lodges had secrets. They had words, and they had gestures, and they had rituals, etc. But they also are constantly the subject of what was called exposures. They're constantly being referenced in print. Their rituals are constantly being published. Always it is said by disaffected Masons, but in fact we have no idea who's putting these things out. It could very well be the lodges themselves. So the paradox here is that on one hand they appear to be secret, on the other hand they're not. On one hand they are persecuted in some places and have to be careful, but in other places they have a free rein. They publicly parade in Britain in the 18th century. They met at court in Sweden in the 18th century. There's nothing very secretive about that. So it's trying to sort of unpack this idea of secrecy and how did it actually work? And why is it always invoked? One of my favorite books is a book in Dutch about the Freemasons, and it claims that it's going to reveal all the secrets. it goes on at some length, and then it says, now here's the secret coming, and you turn the page, and it's blank. That's a perfect metaphor for.
That really is. That's sort of the running joke in a lot of lodges. What's the secret? There isn't one. You mentioned, though, that the openness was taking place in Britain. How about on the continent? Was it the same taking place there?
It varies. It varies enormously. Remember, in Catholic Europe, after 1738, Catholics were forbidden to join the lodges. Now, in fact, this didn't stop them. And so you can find in lodges in France, for example, abbés who belong. Now, they're not supposed to be there, but they're obviously there and having a very good time. But they have to be careful. So, again, secrecy then becomes a way of integrating people who might otherwise be in trouble or embarrassed by the fact that they have become members. Or if you go to some place where the Inquisition operates, in Avignon, for example, or in Naples, there you can find actual persecution right up to the late 18th century. So again, conditions varied enormously depending on where you are. In general, the lodges are not as suspect in Protestant Europe as they are in Catholic Europe, although, again, there are exceptions, important exceptions, in all places.
It sounds as if it's almost the social and political climate driven as to whether or not it was open or not. In an environment perhaps where it was a little bit more tolerated, that it would be more open, and where not, it would try to stay more underground.
Yeah.
Would that be a good distillation of
yes,
hiding where they need to and not hiding where they don't need to?
Right.
And this next question, you've probably touched on it, and maybe in the broader sense we can get an idea of it. Do you find that the secrecy is a common theme in the studies? Is it a frequent mantra that there's secrets, yet you still find these materials printed and published?
In the 18th century, yes, there's a lot of material printed that claims to be an expose of the ritual in particular. But you also most commonly find a harping on the secrecy by anti-Masonic writers. In that sense, the lodges set themselves up for trouble in just claiming that they had these secrets. So you begin to get, by the 1740s, an anti-Masonic literature that harps on the fact that this is a secret society, etc.
Okay. So as these pamphlets and anti-Masonic aspects started to creep up in the 1740s, was there an escalation as it started to progress, especially as it sprouted in the continental America with the anti-Masonic party? Was there a growth to this, or did it stay pretty sedate for a while and then start to become stronger here in America?
It heats up in the 1770s, in part because of the appearance in Germany of a sect that's modeled on the Freemasons that called itself the Illuminati. I just saw a preview of the new Dan White film, Angels and Demons, and I see that they're going to make much out of these Illuminati. Now, there were about 600 people who were Illuminati, and most of them were in jail by the middle of the 1770s. But that then turned up the temperature, and it's very much turned up in the 1780s. In fact, one of the most interesting things that I know about French Freemasonry as opposed to English or German or whatever is that the amount of infighting that's going on in the lodges in France suggests a society that is deeply fractured. Indeed, somebody could write a very interesting book just going through all the correspondence between the Grand Lodge in Paris and all these other lodges out in the countryside who resent the Grand Lodge, who see it as engaged in an aristocratic takeover. There's all this resentment and hostility being shown from one lodge to another, suggesting that this is a society that's got some pretty serious problems, and these problems will come to the surface, of course, in 1789.
And for how long did they persist? Did these sort of grumblings continue on for decades following, or was there, in what you found, some resolution to it at that time?
Well, you, again, the revolution changes everything to the extent that what happens after the French Revolution, particularly in those countries that didn't have a revolution, liberals, people who are interested in reforming these ancien regimes that they feel need to be revolutionized, tended to flock to Freemasonry. And so the lodges become, in Italy, for example, they're filled with secularists and liberals who are interested in reform, who want to eventually unify Italy and so forth. The same is true in Belgium. The Revolution of 1830 has a very strong Masonic presence there. So this polarizing that comes out of the Revolution continues into the 19th century. And then, of course, in America, you get the anti-Masonic Party, which has very different roots from the anti-Freemasonry you find in Europe. But it's still part of the story of the reaction against this 18th century form of sociability.
This may be jumping ahead a little bit, but I just want the question seems to fit at this point. And this is bringing from the past discussion to more of a modern-day perspective. Do you see a contrast in European masonry and the development of American masonry through that period to today?
Well, I do see a very different development. I can't emphasize enough the importance of the right-wing opposition to Freemasonry in Europe. What this means is that in the 20th century, European Freemasons, particularly on the continent, wherever fascism emerges, are persecuted. And that persecution of the 1940s, what that means is in 1946, again, you have an upsurge of Freemasonry, but it's an upsurge very much as a way of showing hostility to Nazism and fascism. By comparison, American Freemasonry had it very easy in the 20th century. None of these persecutory movements can be of any significance in the 20th century in America. So I think membership in a lodge meant something different here from what it meant in Europe.
I'm curious, if you had to encapsulate what that difference was, how would you... Is it possible to encapsulate that?
Well, one thing that I've seen in my own lifetime is that you can find in Europe really bona fide academic historians who have an interest in Freemasonry. This is particularly true in France, and are themselves members of lodges, both of mixed lodges and solely male lodges. And there's a really respectable, lively, scholarly world there. Whereas in this country, Freemasonry just hasn't found its place in the academy at all. There's a real gulf there between what the local Masonic historians, for instance, work on and how they work, and what we do as professional historians. There's just not a lot of connection. And the other thing that you see in Europe now is the founding of centers for the study of fraternalism in Britain, in France, in Spain, in the Netherlands. And these are quite serious research entities that are interested in all aspects of civil society, but also, of course, in fraternalism and in Freemasonry in general.
This makes me want to ask the question, especially given your past experience at the Grand Lodge of England and your initial inquiry into the documents. Have you met with a lot of resistance with your ideas from some of the more institutional past history or the historic study of Freemasonry?
Yes, I've certainly met resistance around this issue of 1717, and very slowly but surely the scholarly tide has turned, and we now, I think, have so much proof that 1717 is something of an artificial construction. I think perhaps the most controversial aspect of my work might be, I don't know, but it might be that, of course, I'm very interested in the lodges of adoption, the women's lodges of the 18th century, of which there were many. And I've also written extensively on that. And, of course, that for some American Masons might be seen to be controversial.
I'm curious what some of these challenges have been. Has anybody attempted a scholarly work to challenge it, or has it been more just a tut-tut scoffing at it, perhaps? I'm curious what your experience has been and what you've heard back on that.
Well, in the Academy, I've had respectful reviews for my books, but there's a younger generation coming up of scholars who are now beginning to be interested in this topic. But among my generation, it was just seen as irrelevant, not interesting. Now, Stephen Bullock, who's written on American Freemasonry, is a big exception to that. We now have the work of Jessica Harlan Jacobs, who has written on imperialism and the way in which the lodges were used in the British Empire as building blocks for social life, and also for bringing the indigenous peoples, in some cases, into the lodges. And this is all, you know, relatively new work, and it's very, very encouraging that it's starting to happen.
I'm curious to see what the eventual outgrowth will be with it. From an academic perspective, what's the reception been of students as they encounter this field of study? Is there a growing interest from perhaps not the scholars themselves yet, the historians, but the students that are actually learning from them?
Yes, in the sense that every autumn, the great joy of teaching is that you teach freshmen. And there's always a supply of freshmen every autumn. And I teach on the Enlightenment in general. I'll mention Freemasonry, and invariably somebody will come up to me and say, my grandfather, my uncle, et cetera, was a Freemason. What does that mean? So they're interested in this, and I try to direct them to a book or something that they would find useful. So yes, they're interested, I think, because they've got it in their family. Although generally it's not their father, it's their grandfather.
The generation that it missed, it goes back a little bit. With the study of it, as it starts to grow, do you see it as a topic of study into itself or an aspect of perhaps a broader subject, say, civil society?
I think it's an aspect of the study of civil society. I think all this kind of group behavior is can be studied on a local basis, for what it tells you about the sociology of a particular setting, a town, a city. But it can also be a way into attitudes and mentalities. You've got here a body of information that has left written records, and that's very useful and very important. So there's a lot of different ways of approaching that sort of material. I mean, I'm very interested in the way in which all the different forms of civil society work to inculcate politeness and decorum. And this civilizing move is very important in creating a society that is open to change and open to new ideas.
I want to add one footnote, Greg, before we go too far, and that is it was mentioned a few minutes ago about Jessica Harlan Jacobs. I just wanted, as people are listening to this show, that they can go back to episode 14 and listen to Jessica Harlan Jacobs as referred to about 5 minutes ago. That's all I want to say.
we did have actually we did have her on and we spoke briefly about your work and she definitely benchmarked it as an important progression into the study in trying to understand it and it's definitely a very important aspect, I guess, as we start to move into university that it is taken seriously and not necessarily as just a past fraternity, perhaps, I guess would be a good way of saying it. And I'm curious how university looked at it before. Have you ever encountered anything that ever spoke about the perception of Freemasonry in the past in university, or is it just a topic that was overlooked?
It was basically, in this country, a topic that was mostly overlooked, at least in the post-war era, which is the historical writing that I know the best, and the material that comes out from the 1940s onward. And I'm not quite sure why. And partly may be that the lodges themselves lost their academic members beginning in the 1960s. I know there used to be a lodge at UCLA and a lodge at Berkeley, and there is now no such thing. That may be part of it. There are a lot of different aspects here.
Did you have something you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I have a few questions coming in off of the our forum while they're listening to our show, and one of them going back a few minutes ago was asking about whether Margaret, whether you feel that there was an invention of Masonic history and tradition. Do you think, or I guess asking you to comment on whether you feel that the Masonic history and tradition was invented, or whether it's I guess the opposite of that is whether there's a real Masonic history. I don't know where that's going, but do you feel that some of it was invented?
Oh, clearly. I mean, once Freemasonry leaves the confines of the Grand Lodge of London and goes on to the continent and comes also to the New World, in a sense, nobody's in charge. And what you get is the invention of ritual and the invention of new forms of sociability, and you get a kind of experimenting that's quite interesting from a historical point of view. And now, for example, you also have this kind of experimenting going on because there are now people setting up lodges in this country that are affiliated with France and that admit men and women as equals and try to integrate the lodges more as to race and gender. And that's a new development. Where that will go, who knows?
Another question we had then, it was actually coming out of a comment of Greg's about missing the generation gap between grandfathers and grandsons. So the question, I guess, is... why do you feel that there was that generation missing in the last half century between the, you say that they connect more with the, you know, a senior figure in their family, like a grandfather or an uncle or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that there's that missing gap?
Right. I mean, I just tell you a story. 20 years ago, the chair of the history department at NYU was asked to draw up a 5-year plan. And he responded with one sentence memo, which read, "Historians do not predict the future." So, getting me to comment on events of the last 20 or 30 years, I have no purchase on truth here any more than anybody else has. So I'm just going to go by what I see. I frequently lecture at lodges around the country, and 3 or 4 years ago, I was at a southern city in Louisiana that will go nameless, and there were about 200 brothers and their wives who turned up, and there wasn't a single black face in the audience, not one. So I think part of what's going on here is that the younger generation, people who are today in their 40s, let's say, because their kids are 18 and they're in our classrooms. They live in a much more open and integrated kind of society than did their grandfathers or the 18-year-old's grandfather. And for one thing, when I was in graduate school in the 1960s, there wasn't a tenured woman on any history faculty of any consequence in the country. There was no woman at Cornell, where I went to get my PhD, at UCLA, at Berkeley, at Princeton, at Harvard, you name it. And I had wonderful professors who did a tremendous job teaching, but who would say openly, and as far as I'm concerned, there never will be a woman in this department. Well, all that has been revolutionized. We now have women doctors and lawyers and professors on a scale unimaginable 30 years ago. And the men who've lived through that, most of them have taken it for granted that that's the way society is. It's integrated. There's equal opportunity employers. There's affirmative action. There are all of these social restraints being put on how people can or should behave. My freshman, again, that touchstone of freshman, the 18-year-old, 45% of our freshmen this year and last, and for a couple of years now in a row, both with us and at Berkeley, about 45% of that class is Asian American, Vietnamese American, Chinese American, Korean American, you name it. Another 11, 12% Hispanic. Now, all these young people, guys and gals, Hispanic, Asian, they all mix and fraternize together. You can see it in the classroom. They form friendships. They're involved with one another's lives. They talk on the phone. It's just a totally more open kind of social experience than certainly what I had when I went to college. And I think it's harder and harder for these young people to relate to something like Freemasonry, except as it's something that their grandfathers talked about, and they want to know what that meant. But would they themselves, in their own lives, be led sort of logically to join the fraternity? I don't know.
The answer that you gave, it strikes me that it may be uniquely an American answer. I'm curious if you've noticed or heard the same is true in Europe.
No, in continental Europe, there is a much greater mixing, at least in my – bear in mind, I only go to lodges as a speaker, an outside speaker, so all I can go by is what I see in the audience, and I do see a much more integrated – bearing in mind that the racial integration is not much at all, because there aren't that many non-whites in any of these European societies. And where there are Muslims, for example, there's terrible segregation outside Paris, and Amsterdam's got a problem. I mean, don't for a second think that anybody else has got some kind of way through the thicket of prejudice and discrimination, because I don't think they do. But certainly on the issue of gender, there you see a completely different kind of thing. I see somebody asking, does Prince Hall fill the gap, especially in this issue of race? Is Prince Hall Freemasonry? And I don't think it does fill the gap. I think it's wonderful for people who are members of Prince Hall. I'm sure they get a great deal out of it, but it still remains the fact that the Southern lodges are deeply segregated.
This may be going back to the reference you made with the department chair of history and prediction of the future, but given this knowledge and what you've said about it, any prognostication as to the future of Freemasonry? Any glimpse into the future from a historian if you had to project?
Wow, that's hard.
You're putting her into a wasp nest, Greg.
Right. I think it's conceivable that in 20 years, all these barriers between race and gender and whatnot will come down. And if they do, I think you will see a renaissance.
It almost seems that skipped generation, that it's because it skipped that generation somehow that Freemasonry is a little bit behind the rest of what society is. I mean, would that be a fair extrapolation? That perhaps as the membership waned in that period and so did some of their perhaps more intellectual influence that way? That so to
oh,
as some of these changes occurred in society, they sort of missed out in this?
Well, I think you certainly could make that argument. I've heard Tom Jackson speak, and Tom he's a wonderful, wonderful person, and he really cares a lot about your future, and he's always going on about how you've got to give a quality experience. There's got to be a knowledge base. There's got to be serious study of your origins and your history and your institutions and your values. And he, I think, if I read him rightly, doesn't think that's happening enough. But again, I just know what I hear. Don't have any personal experience.
Well, Margaret, I must say that's episode 15. It's one of my favorites, actually, and recommend that all listeners listen to Tom Jackson on episode 15 of our show.
We did have Tom on, and actually it was probably one of the more stunning conversations and just sort of getting this reality of American Masonry and European Masonry also, you know, how it exists outside and how it exists inside and the perceptions between the two. He's a terrific speaker. And to your point of what you were discussing there, I know you're coming up here in May to talk at UCLA in regards to something you're doing at the California Grand Lodge. Anything that you could tell us about that event that's coming up?
Well, there is an event where I'm going to be lecturing, and I think what the purpose of the event for the brothers who are there is to try to think about the future and to think about what can be learned from the past that might be relevant to the future. I think one thing that I hope to stress is that in the 18th and early 19th centuries, many large lodges were in the avant-garde. They were ahead of society. They were thinking outside the box. Not all of them, by any means, but there were enough such lodges. And that, I think, is a kind of model that one wouldn't want to lose just because it's a good thing to think outside the box.
This may be a dangerous question to ask, but what exactly does that mean, thinking outside of the box? How would we define, and I'm just asking this just for the sense of clarity in what you're saying. I think I understand what you're saying, but for the audience, how would you define that box and what would be outside of it?
Well, arguably, much of the history of the Western world has been, from the 17th century onward, has been an ongoing struggle to put in place basic rights, constitutional government, freedom of speech, trial by jury. We all know these. And in the 20th century, civil rights, women's rights, racial equality have all been front and center on the agenda of progressive thinkers. And what I'm asking is, where is the Masonic presence now among those who want to see a more just, more equal, a more giving and fair society?
And actually contributing more back to it. Do you think that out of this discussion in UCLA that these ideas will start to come to the surface more? Or do you see that more as an internal conversation that lodges today would have?
Oh, I see that internal conversation. What I would just like to see happen, if we can do this, and the Grand Lodge of the State of California has been wonderfully supportive and eager to try to make this happen, that we can get the study of fraternalism and civil society and Freemasonry back into the academy. So that there isn't this gap between what people think in general out there and what scholars know to have been the case. For instance, I'm constantly being asked to talk on History Channel or wherever about Freemasonry. I'm the single sole beneficiary of Dan White's many books. I only wish I had his royalties. And I am always asked by respectable producers, is there a conspiracy? What do you know about that conspiracy? And at times I just laugh it off, and at other times I just get so fed up. Who set up this kind of thinking? Where did this come from, and why is it being repeated? It's paranoid thinking, it's nutty, it's destructive, and it's uneducated, quite frankly.
I have a question, Margaret. Earlier, very much like near the beginning of the show, you brought up the Illuminati, and we sometimes on some of these websites get linked to the Illuminati somehow.
Yeah.
Is there an Illuminati still? And can you comment on the fact that we're not, we have nothing to do with them?
Yeah.
I guess I'm answering the question for you. But.
All right, you are, sir. But no, there are no Illuminati. There were only about 600 Illuminati in the 1770s in Germany, and half of them were in jail within a year. Almost every form of male and female fraternizing has copied one or another form of Freemasonry. You guys just got out of the gate faster than anybody else. So all these different societies that form in the late 18th century, like the Illuminati, take up aspects of Masonic practices. This is true in Ireland, the United Irishmen, who are founded in the 1790s to try to promote reform and Catholic equality, etc. They consciously imitated Masonic forms. Therefore, there's a link in the sense that it's like you set up a university. Well, where are you going to go to get an example of how a university should function? Well, for many, many years, the Japanese came to this country to look at how our universities function and tried to imitate some aspects thereof. Does this mean that they're the same thing? Of course not. So having said all that, the Illuminati are a short-lived, highly persecuted, rather dreamy in their attitudes and values. They wanted to reform German society, but they weren't exactly, they were kind of clueless as to how to go about that. And it is also true that the authorities reacted with a vengeance, because obviously these German princes were afraid that some kind of reform movement would get started. And this is only exacerbated. These fears come to the surface precisely with the American Revolution. You can have a revolt against one monarch, surely you can have a revolt against another monarch. And from that time onward, right through to the French Revolution, all these ancien regimes in Europe are quaking. They are afraid that this contagion is going to spread.
Of course they would be. It's their livelihood as a monarch. The
yes,
livelihood being pretty a big livelihood, big emphasis put on live there.
Courts are fun.
What's that?
I say courts and courtiers and dances and balls and all that power and all that prestige and money. What's not to love?
Well, I'm applying for that job very shortly, Margaret. Do you know where I can apply for that? Or do they still have that position? No?
Not that I'm aware of. Well, I suppose Saudi Arabia, but then I'm not sure we want to exactly imitate Saudi society. I mean, you have to go pretty far nowadays to find a monarch in good standing.
Yeah, I'd say so. Dean, any questions out there in the gallery? Anybody that wants to actually come up and ask a question? Does anybody want to ask
hour.
A question? There is a question here. Hold on one second. You talk to Margaret for a second, and
okay.
I'll.
Margaret, are you okay with taking a question from our audience?
Sure. I'm
excellent.
Delighted.
Okay.
Terrence, are you there right now, buddy?
Yeah.
Did you want to ask your question? I see you had a nice question there.
Sure. Dr. Jacob, you briefly mentioned something about co-masonry in the United States, and we had talked about the progression of Freemasonry and how it needed to get back ahead of that societal curve. Do you feel that accepting co-masonry is an essential progression in Freemasonry due to the changes in society?
Yes, I do. No, that's going to get me in trouble with all sorts of folks, but I do.
Well, I will say one thing, though, is that I can sympathize with that question in one way, and I can see that as an easy way to advance, but at the same time, I myself have been explaining recently to people about why it's, it's men only, and we keep it, to keep the lodge on the level, and so to speak. So I struggle in the fact that I see what you're saying, and at the same time, I see it as a very big advantage to have, to keep things, internal swirls, and keeps one element of things out, so it's almost like a meditation or a meditative state where you have fewer things to worry about. So for me, it's a difficult question. A difficult question with, obviously, would be the easy way for us to progress, I think, if we could ever get past that. But I don't know if we'd be sacrificing too much to go that far. I don't know.
I think just to what you were saying, though, and even with the answer of it, it's certainly in the broader spectrum of the discussion, and especially as it starts to go back into the aspects of civil society. In becoming a 21st century organization, not to say that it's necessarily to do that you have to go a certain direction, but to have the mechanics to talk about that. And mm-hmm. I think that's sort of where the first steps would be. In any sort of discussion, it's never a way to have an absolute to it. And I'm curious in what you found in your study of the history of it, Margaret. Have you found that these discussions have sort of bubbled up at different periods and then faded into the background? Or has that sort of been the 500-pound gorilla in the corner that never gets brought up?
Oh, it gets brought up in the 18th century constantly. There were enormous objections raised to the lodges of adoption. They were controversial from the get-go, but they continue to spread, interestingly enough. They're found in French-speaking Europe, and this includes the Netherlands, where the elites tended to speak French. You can find them in Vienna. You can find them in Paris. It just seems to be... This is the problem with when you start talking about equality and meeting upon the level. People get ideas in their heads that this might actually pertain to them. And then when that happens, you get social experimentation and people wanting to press the envelope and say, well, how far can we go here? So, yes, it was always, always contentious.
There's a comment in the gallery that I guess I must have accidentally called you Mildred, Margaret. I don't think I did, but I apologize reverse if I did call you Mildred by accident. Maybe it was a slip of my accent. I'm not sure. I do have a strong Canadian accent.
Many of my relatives are in Canada, so I'm used to listening to Canadian accents.
we're actually coming right up to the end of the hour here, and I don't want to go on too long as I don't want the application to turn us off. So I just wanted to ask in real briefly, any new works in on the horizon to look out for? Or
well, yes, I've got a book coming out. It's got three authors, myself, Lynn Hunt, and a Dutch colleague, Vinod Meinhardt. It's coming out with Harvard University Press, and it's called The Secular Search for the Sacred. And it's about this early 18th century group that I started the conversation telling you about. So in a curious way, it doesn't have much to do with Freemasonry as such, but it has to do with a book that was one of the first places that people in Europe could learn about Freemasonry. This was a 7-volume work called The Ceremonies and Religious Customs of All the People of the World. And we've just written a book about it.
Hey, when's it due out? Anytime soon?
Well, if they're copy editing it now, and I suspect it'll come out in the autumn of 2009, but possibly in the spring of 2010.
Very nice. We'll have to keep our eyes open. Any chance we could get you to come back on the show when it comes out?
Sure. I'd be delighted.
Excellent. Excellent. Dean, anything you've got to throw in? I know we're right at the hour here, so.
No, I think I've said my piece and had trouble communicating earlier, so I think I think you're going to cut me off soon.
Well,
I'm not able to pick through my words very well tonight, so.
It sounds good to me, man. Hey, Professor Jacob, Margaret, thank you very much for coming on the program. If you can stick around for a few minutes, I know there'll be a lot of questions that are coming, especially at the end of our conversation here, some of the topics that came up. So any extra time you can give, that would be very much appreciated. I wanted to get to your books again. The 3 books that we mentioned at the beginning of the shows, the Origins of Freemasonry Facts and Fictions by University of Pennsylvania Press is still available on Amazon. Living the Enlightenment, Freemasonry and Politics in the 18th Century Europe, and the Radical Enlightenment, Pantheists, Freemasons, and Republicans, also all available at Amazon.com at this point. Hopefully we'll have them up in our store soon to link to, and look for her coming book, The Secular Search for the Sacred, due out this autumn, perhaps spring of 2010. Thanks very much, Margaret. I very much appreciate you coming on and having this conversation with us, and in helping to educate us.
My pleasure entirely.
And
about 5 minutes.
Okay, and for all you guests out there, we do have shows coming up in the future. They'll be loaded into our talk show calendar soon. Next week we have Harm Timmerman, who's coming to us out of the Netherlands with the music from his recent CD, The Temple of Humanity, the Music of Freemasonry. So that's next week on the 22nd at 6 o'clock. I guess that's it. So this is Brother Greg Stewart saying travel light, and
this is Dean Kennedy saying see you in the East.
Good night, everybody.